Okay, so we will continue with the second half of the tutorial. So this is now about this using the unified modeling language to develop security critical applications and using specifically this extension UML stack of the unified modeling language. So yeah, first again, we've seen already in the first half of the tutorial that there are a lot of problems related to computer security, so I don't have to motivate this really here. And we've seen a couple of specific causes in the on the technical level, but now the question is, so how can one treat this in a general way? So I've pointed out few specific vulnerabilities and a few specific attacks and a few specific solutions for these attacks. But now the question is, how can we treat the whole problem in a systematic way? And this is the motivation for this part of the tutorial. So as I mentioned already, the problem is often that the system is attacked by considering the boundaries between different components in the system. So you cannot just use the security mechanisms in a blind way, in a way. So you cannot just take SSL and then say, oh, now my system is secure because I'm using cryptography. That's too simple. And also I mentioned already, once a system has been attacked, also related to the earlier question, using these scripts that are dispersed over the internet, the information on attacks can spread very quickly. So security is that is a problem there. That once your system is attacked successfully, you can be sure that it will happen again and again. And in practice, the problem also is that the designers of secure systems don't usually get a feedback from their customers because the information is so sensitive. Even the fact that a system may have been attacked, companies often just don't want to admit this fact. For example, if you deal with banks, then they would rather pay for the damage themselves as opposed to publish the fact that they were attacked, because otherwise their customers would run away. So they want to avoid that. And this is a problem when designing security systems, because you never know how well your system works in practice, because they will not tell you. And so the way systems development has been done in the past was firstly the penetrate and patch approach, where you develop your system and you may even use it, and then eventually it may be attacked, and then you you write a patch for the specific vulnerability and then you distribute the patch. But this is not a very good approach, because it's firstly insecure, because you don't know how much time goes by after the attack is first found and after you realize that this is the case, or until you realize that this is the case. So there may already be much damage being done in between. And also it's disruptive, because you have to you have to give out all these patches, which is expensive, and also your customers will not have much confidence in you in the future if this happens. An alternative approach to that has been also tried in the past, namely that of formal methods, where you make a mathematically precise model of your system, and you try to establish at the level of this model that your system is secure to some extent, or to this degree of abstraction anyway. And this is better than just using the penetrate and patch approach, because you may find a lot of attacks before you actually implement the system. So this means that it's secure and you don't have to modify your system afterwards. So you may also save some money in principle, because you don't have to change the system after it's implemented. Only again, then you don't really usually save money, because using these formal methods are relatively expensive, because the people who use them need rather deep mathematical training and using these formal methods, and you have to construct formal specifications of your system in order to be able to use them. So yeah, the alternative approach, which is taken in the work that I'm describing now, is firstly also to do security by design. So this is similar in the formal methods approach, but the difference to the formal methods approach is that here we are using a notation which is actually quite well known in industry. And so the general motivation is that you consider security from the start and within the context of system development. And also you make sure that the boundaries between the components are taken care of, so there are no attacks arising from them. And so the motivation for this is this saying by the security experts Salzer and Schröder, who in the 70s already said that you really have to look at the whole system in order to make sure that it's secure. And also in their relatively well-known paper in 75, they stated the fact that there is no complete method to do this yet, and unfortunately this is really true until today. So the last 25 years, or 27 years now, and this hasn't been changed in principle. And this is the motivation for this work that I'm presenting here. So this has, in the long run, the motivation to provide such a method. But there's still some work to do to make it really complete. And yeah, so firstly, some words about this notation. So as I mentioned already, it's based on the unified modeling language. This is a notation for specifying object-oriented systems, which has been proposed in 1996, and since then it has really been become very popular also in industry, and it allows you to specify your system with a graphical notation, and this allows you to take different views on the system. So, for example, you can specify the physical environment, you can specify the class structure of the system, and the interaction between the different system components, and which is quite useful. And also it allows you to take a relatively abstract view on the system, which is also useful for our purpose here, because if you can abstract from details that are not needed, then this allows you to concentrate on the aspects which are really important for the security. And also an advantage is that it's really an industry standard by the OMG, the Object Management Group, which developed this notation. And you also have standard extension mechanisms, meaning that you can extend the notation UML to your specific application domain, which in this case is the domain of security critical systems. And this extension I will present here now, called UMLSec, so it's UML for security, and the goal is to write your UML specifications of your system, as you might do anyway, then to add some security relevant information. For example, you can label the parts of your system that are security relevant, and on that way you can evaluate the UML specifications for possible vulnerabilities on the design level. So there are quite a few attacks which you can actually already detect on the design level, and these you can found using this approach. And also the other attacks, which are not immediately obvious on the design level, you can also treat with this approach, for example, by generating test sequences using these specifications. And those test sequences you can then use to test the system and to find out that it is actually, that the system itself is actually secure, not just the design. And this way you can make this information on secure systems development available to developers who may not themselves be specifically trained in security. So, and also another thing which I mentioned already, you have to consider security through the software lifecycle, and this you can also do using this approach, because you can use the different diagrams from the early part of the design on. And specifically, one aim of this approach is if you're concerned with certification, which means that you want to have your system certified by an official agency that it satisfies a certain level of security, then this could be done more or less expensively using this approach, because this UML certification language is relatively well known, so you probably don't have to train your people too much in applying the certification language. So yeah, this is just a slide to tell you how, in principle, these diagrams can look like. So you have different kinds of diagrams on this slide. There are six different kinds, and I will explain them in more detail on the next slide. But the point is that you can use this kind of different kinds of diagrams to specify different views on the system. So here we have the list of the diagrams that are used in this work. So this is firstly the activity diagram, which you can use to specify the flow of control between different system components. Then you can specify the class structure using class diagrams. You can specify the interaction between components by sequence diagrams. And component behavior you can specify with state chart diagrams. Then I mentioned already you have deployment diagrams, where you can specify the physical environment. And lastly, you have packages, where you can collect your different parts of the system specification into groups. So activity diagrams look in principle like the one example given on the slide. So you have different boxes, which are the states. So this is similar to a state machine, where these the seven different boxes on the diagram characterize different states of the system. So at each point in time of the system is in one of these states, and the differences between the states is that they can be that different internal variables have different values. For example, the state in the left upper corner says NT equals 0, so we have an internal variable of the system component which is set to 0 at that state. And you have arrows between the different states to signify that you may have a transition from one state to another state. And in the upper part of the diagram, you can specify the different objects that are specified in this diagram. In this example, you have three objects. Namely, an object C of class card, an object L of class LSAM, and an object I of class Assure. So these are the important concepts of activity diagrams. then you can specify the class structure of the system. In this example, it's a really simple example. You have two classes. Each of them is specified by this rectangle. So on the left side, you have a class whose name is CLS1. This has an attribute @1 of type @tie1. And there's also an operation which is offered by the class, namely the one called op1, which has one argument, arg1 of type a tie1, and the return value of type r tie1. So these class models you can use to specify the name, the attributes, and the operations offered by a class.
So the file C, the braces, and the target object.
Okay. Yes. So in UML, you can. I will explain on the later slide that you can extend the notation of UML using so-called stereotypes and tags. And these curly braces are the notation that you can use for tags. So this is additional information that you can add to the UML diagrams. And I will explain in more detail what this means exactly. But just in general, you can specify the class structure. And here, for example, there are two classes, and there is a dependency from the right class to the left class. So the right class, in some sense, depends on the left class. And more specifically, the dependency here is specified to be call dependency, which means that the class 2 can call an operation in class 1. Yeah, so this is the general idea of the class size. The point is, of course, that if you look at this level, you can only find the attacks that are possible at that level. But as I mentioned, the approach then is that firstly you make sure that the system is secure on the abstract model level, and then you implement the system, and then you can use this test. You can generate test sequences from the model to make sure that the implementation actually does what the model says. And
I must be sure that this good working model can be implemented.
Yes. That's also important.
Are there tools, or are there, for instance, if I'm talking about the operating system, are there languages that I cannot use to fully implement tests made by UML models?
The UML specifications are more directed at the application level. Because they are object oriented, you would probably use them for Java applications, but not at the operation system level. Usually not. You could, but that's not so much of the focus here. It's more the application level.
So there are languages that are most used to implement UML models.
Yeah, so for example, object-oriented languages like Java or C++, and sometimes you can even generate code from these diagrams, at least part of the code. So there are tools which you can use to draw the UML diagrams, and then these tools generate the class definitions of the diagrams. Yes, exactly, yeah. Okay, so the next kind of diagram is that of sequence diagrams. So these you can use to specify the interaction between different objects or system components, which is being done by exchanging messages. So the way this looks like is that the different objects in the system are given in the top line. So in this example, you have an object C of class client, an object S of class server, and then you have these vertical boxes or lines, which are the live lines of the objects, and then you have arrows coming from these lines or going to the lines. And an object, an arrow, like in the first line, going from the object C to the object S, means that according to the specification, the object C should send the message to the object S. And then here it's the message with name init, which has three arguments, ni, kc, and the signature of something. So this notation I will also explain in more detail. This already refers to cryptographic operations, because that's important when we use security. But in principle, you could also use it without these more complicated arguments. Important in the security setting is to note that this specification really only means that the object C is supposed to send the message init to the object S. So given the situation that in between we may have an untrusted network like the internet, we cannot be sure that the message will actually arrive at the object S. So the at least the object C does not know this. And if we write the specification, we have to be careful there. So in principle, you can view this as two parts of the specification. Firstly, the part related to the object C, where you can say, okay, the object sends out the init message and hopes that the message will get to the object S. But we don't know this, we just hope, because it's an untrusted network. And then we wait until we get a message with name resp, which seems to come from the object S. Although that, again, we don't know, because it's an untrusted network. So this is something we have to be careful about here in this notation. So you have messages between objects, and then you can specify guards, which are conditions on which it depends whether the message is actually being sent. And these may be equations between cryptographic expressions. So, for example, you may receive a message, then you decrypt it, and if you see that the content is of a certain value, then you go on with the protocol, and otherwise you stop, so that you can specify this way. And another kind of diagram is that of the state charts, which you can use to specify the behavior of an object or component. So similar to the activity diagram, you again have states and transitions between states. Only here the diagram specifies the behavior of one object or one component, whereas in the activity diagram case, the point was to coordinate the behavior between different components or objects. But otherwise the notation is relatively similar. So in this case, the meaning is, firstly, when the object is started, the state on the right-hand side is entered, namely the initial state. Then the object waits for the message called message, and if the condition, if a certain condition is fulfilled, then a certain action is being executed, and the new state on the left-hand side is entered. So that's the intuitive meaning of this very simple diagram. And the next kind of diagram, the deployment diagram, there you can specify the physical layer of your system. So you have firstly, you can specify the components of your system, which is this rectangle with these two little rectangles on the side. And you can specify on which physical node in the system this component resides. So the component may, for example, be the web server, and the node may be a specific computer where the web server is running. And then you may have a physical connection to another node where there's another computer. And on that computer you may have the software for the user application which calls the web server. And then there has to be some sort of logical dependency between these two logical components, and this you can also specify using this arrow. And as I mentioned, you can put all these kinds of diagrams together in a package, and there you have then the specification of a system or the part of a system from different points of views. So here in the bottom part of the package you have a deployment diagram which gives you the physical layer of the system, and then you above that you have a very, in each case it's very simple, of course, to have it on one slide. So you have an extremely simple kind of class diagram with only two classes, and this way you can specify where these classes sit actually in the physical system. And then on the left there's a very simple activity diagram which says that the two classes are executed concurrently, and on the top you have a state chart which specifies the behavior of the one class, namely the one in the object S. And the package also may have interfaces on the left side specified to specify what operations of the the package are accessible to the outside of this system component. And I mentioned already that UML offers certain expansion mechanisms which allow you to adapt the notation to a specific application domain, such as security critical systems. So firstly, you have a stereotype, which is a label, which is some kind of label in these angled brackets, and these you can use to say that a certain diagram or a certain part of the diagram should have a specific meaning. And we will see examples of that later. And the second kind of thing refers to the earlier question, so the tag value in curly brackets, where you can attach further data to a specific diagram part, and also that we will see in more detail. And then you can add constraints which have to be fulfilled in order to be for the diagram to be correctly written. And all of these this information you can gather in so-called profiles, which enable you to define this specific extension of UML in a coherent way. And so this I will explain here now, namely the profile related to the security extension UMLSec. So firstly, the general idea to define such an extension is that the security properties which you are usually concerned about, there are many of such requirements which recur quite frequently. And examples of that were already mentioned in the earlier part, for example, confidentiality, also called secrecy, or integrity. So these are requirements which come up a lot, and which you can therefore make precise using this notation, and you can exploit the fact that they occur frequently to deal with them in a secure and efficient way. And using these constraints that you can define for diagrams, you can then make sure that the properties that are intended to be fulfilled by the system are actually met by the behavior which is specified using the state charts or the activity diagrams. And this way you can on the one hand make sure that the requirements that are stated in the diagrams, such as security, such as secrecy or integrity, actually enforce the security policy that your system should fulfill. And on the other hand, you can then make sure that the system design actually provides these security requirements. And on the next step, referring to the earlier question, you can then generate test sequences that I will mention in the end in order to make sure that the implementation actually does what the specification says that it should do. So firstly, if one wants to design such an extension of UML, one may think about what kind of properties the extension should have. So I gave a list of requirements on such an extension here. Firstly, one should think that these mentioned basic security requirements one should be able to specify in the diagrams. Then one should be able to consider different threat scenarios and to evaluate the diagrams with respect to these threat scenarios, and also be able to consider different strengths of adversaries. So depending on the application, you may be worried about script kids who want to hack your website, or on the other extreme, if you consider very business critical systems where a lot of money is involved, you will have to think about attackers which are more highly motivated than script kiddies. So it's good to be able to take consideration of this fact in on the modeling level also. And then you often have specific security concepts such as tamper-resistant hardware, and it's good to be able to include this into your specification to be able to consider in what sense this enforces security requirements. And another thing one would be able to do is that one would want to make use of existing standard security mechanisms such as access control and also include them in the specification. So on a more lower technical level, what is important is that I can use security primitives such as encryption functions within my model, and also be able to consider the underlying physical security. And then something which is also quite useful is if I can consider security management, like secure workflow, for example. And then some things which are which would be quite useful on in addition to the more general requirements is if I can specify or include specific information which relates to specific application environments such as Java-based systems or COBOL and so on. And so these requirements are all meant to be satisfied by this UML extension, and I will explain how this is being done in more detail. So coming back to the different kinds of diagrams, you can just as a general idea how to use these different kinds of diagrams. First, the activity diagrams you can then use to enforce that the control flow between different parts of the system is done securely. The class diagrams you can use to specify the security levels of data in your classes and to make sure that the level is preserved when the data is exchanged between different classes. And the sequence diagram you can use to evaluate that security critical interaction is done correctly. The state chart diagram you can make sure that within the behavior of one object the security is preserved. So for example, you can exclude indirect information flow within one object. And then you can use deployment diagrams to relate the system structure to the security which may be provided by the physical layer of the system. And lastly, you can use packages in order to provide what I mentioned earlier, namely the need that you really have to take a holistic view on system security. So, yeah, how does this UML SEC profile look like then in principle? So this is just a small part of the profile. So firstly, in principle, the way such a profile is defined is that you give a table with the different stereotypes, which are at this point simply labels, which you can put into your diagram, and you say at which part of the diagram the stereotype can be attached to. These are the so-called base classes. Then you can specify that a stereotype has certain tags attached to it, and that the specification has to fulfill certain constraints for a given stereotype. And on the right column, you have a short description. So this is just the general structure of such a profile. I won't explain this table in detail, but I will give a few examples on the next slide, explaining the some of these stereotypes in more detail. So the first stereotypes I will explain here are of a rather general nature. So what you can do is, and you can use this internet stereotype to specify that a communication link in the diagram should be an internet link. The examples come later, I think, so I'll just explain it this way now. In your deployment diagram, you have you can specify communication links, and then you can use these kind of stereotypes to say what kind of communication link that should be in the diagram. And this helps you not only to keep track of this information yourself, but you can then later also use the information to derive a security evaluation of the specification. And the way this works is that firstly you can specify adversary types, as I mentioned already, you can then say what a given adversary can do to a specific system component or system communication link of a specific kind. So on this slide, as an example, I have specified the default attacker, and there's this list which says that on communication links marked internet, the default attacker can firstly simply delete all messages on the link, or can also delete specific messages after having read them. Then the adversary can read all messages that go over the link, and can also insert new messages. So that's what the first line in this table means. Then with encrypted internet links, the adversary can still delete all the messages by simply cutting the wire or whatever, by some physical means, but cannot do the other kinds of actions, because these would assume or would need the adversary to be able to actually break the encryption, which is, which here we assume to be impossible. And then on the different other kinds of connections, like local area network, the adversary is not able to do anything, because the default adversary is supposed to be an outsider and not an insider. So this is a general way of specifying what an adversary can do. And then you have specific stereotypes which you can use to specify security requirements in your diagram. And one example is the stereotype secure link. So if your package, which contains your system specification, carries this label secure link, this means that the specification given in the diagram package has to fulfill a certain constraint, which is given there, namely that whenever you have two components, which are connected by a logical dependency, which may say, for example, component 1 can call an operation at component 2, and if this dependency is marked with a certain security requirement, such as secrecy, then the physical communication link, which is given in the deployment diagram, has to fulfill a certain conditions. Namely, the conditions are that the considered adversary is not able, for example, in the case of secrecy, to read the messages that are sent over the link. So,
as an example,
if you have node 91, another node N2, and there are components in there, say C1 and C2, and you have a dependency from C2 to C1, which is marked with secrecy, then firstly you need to have a physical link between the two nodes in order to even provide this communication between the two components. And this constraint now says that the stereotype on this link, which could be, for example, internet, that the threat scenario does not allow the adversary to read the data that is sent over the dependency. So in the case of the default attacker, in this example, this constraint would not be fulfilled, because we have an internet connection between the two nodes, and dependency would require secrecy, but as we can see in the table, on the internet, the default attacker can read all messages, so the secrecy constraint is not fulfilled by this little example. And you have, if you have other constraints like integrity on the bottom, there the adversary should not be able to insert messages. And then you have this the stereotype high, which says that if you consider the situation of a multi-level secure system, that you are on the high level, and there you should not be able to do anything, to neither to insert messages, nor to read the messages. So in this context, the stereotypes concern dependencies. So, but later you can also use them to specify the data. I will explain this later. So you can use them on different model elements, and here they are used on the dependency.
Another question: the S equal secrecy stereotype. Mm-hmm. I think here you should write read any, not element of threat, not read all.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Read any.
So in this setting, I have I only have this one action, read all, and
you should specify have another one, read any maze, or it should.
Well, I suppose if you can read any message, you can also read all of them by iterating the process.
Yes.
And of course, if you can read all, then you can also look just at one of them. So, and on that level of abstraction, I guess it comes down to the same thing.
I believe I can read any, but I cannot read all. Maybe if I can read all, I can read any, but if I read any, maybe.
Yeah, but if you then iterate the process, firstly you read one, and then you read another, and so on. Then in the end, you read all.
Yes.
So, I think that on this level of abstraction, this is equivalent.
Okay. What's the ELT
element. Yeah, I mean, this is just a way of naming this action.
Yeah, I have a question perhaps it will be explained later, but I jump onto it. Now, from the table and the requirement, this indicated there is a constraint that does not allow this to be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Is the purpose of this language is to do this checking automatically?
Yes, yeah, so in the long run. So, firstly, you can evaluate these diagrams by hand, but then, of course, in the long run, the motivation is to provide tools to do that. And what exists at the moment, we have a tool in Munich, but it's still using a little bit different notation. So I will say a little bit about that in the end. So we have a tool, but with a slightly different notation. And something else that I'm working on at the moment is to use just a standard UML tool like Rational Rows, which you can actually buy, which allows you to draw UML specifications, and from that to automatically analyze your system design in terms of security. But this is still ongoing work at the moment.
Okay, and the other thing is that it discovers inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm.
It does not, or it may, would not in the future be able to tell you how to design the software. Because the final purpose is to develop software with security and conservation.
Yeah.
So if you discover that these constraints are complex, you still don't end up with the developed secure software.
Yeah, okay. So then there are, you could say, two steps. So the first step is to see that something's wrong, and the second step is to see how to make it better. And yeah, I mean, it's true that it's easier to do the first step, and this is the main aim of this approach, is to point out the problems. But the second aim of this approach is also to point out general ways of how to fix problems. But it's still more restricted in this sense, because you may have so many different situations, and to provide advice for every situation would just be a lot of work to incorporate in this approach. So this, and there exists actually something that's called security patterns, which goes into that direction, where the idea is that you have a problem and you have a generic solution to your problem, and this is provided by the approach. So it is actually included in the motivation, but it's probably more work to provide this from the side of the approach. But both things are important, and I would agree there, yeah. Okay. Okay, and here we have the example, so I could have avoided drawing this. I think this is actually, yeah, that's exactly the example which I made there. And yeah, then that the point is that it's violated. This is just what I explained just now. Okay, and similarly, you have this different kind of stereotype called secure dependency. So on the previous kind, you could make sure that the dependencies are actually supported by the physical connections. So the security requirements of the dependency are supported by the physical connection. And now you can make sure that the dependency connect different components in a secure way. I think here is an example. So the idea is that if we have two components here, random generator and key generator, where the one component has a certain security requirement, namely that new key and random, that the data is on the high level in your multi-level security system, then the other component, namely the random generator, also has to make sure that this data is on the same level of security, which in this case is not fulfilled, because there is no tag high in the left component. So yeah, here we can see a use of this tag. So firstly, we have stereotype. In here called, here it's on the right hand side, it's critical, saying that the key generator component is critical in some sense, and then you have tags associated with the critical stereotype, where you can say which of the data should be on the high level, and this way you can then your secure dependency stereotype requires that the information on the data, which data should be high and which shouldn't be high, is actually preserved by these call dependencies. And as I said in this example, this is not being enforced. And yeah.
So I can't just tag the high equals random. I can't see the method random in the key generator.
This must
should
be
there.
Yeah.
It should be there.
It should be there. It should be a typo.
Okay.
Interesting.
Just want to know that.
Okay. Yeah.
So it must be all the tags must all the constraints must be on the same flag.
So there could also be constraint on another class.
It could. Okay.
Yeah.
So what you wanted to say is that you need to add a stereo type on the message ticket source to apply security. I don't know what's the solution to this problem.
Okay, so the it's an extremely simple example again. Here the problem in a way is that the random generator should also, or the solution would be simply to include the same requirement also at the random generator. So at the random generator you should also have the stereotype critical
and rather
Yeah, well, in this case you can trace along these dependencies, namely the call dependency.
Yeah.
So you only have to follow the arrows. So this kind of security requirement is actually the tool could find rather straightforwardly. So there are other security requirements which are more difficult to check. But this one, because it's, you simply have to follow the arrows and see that the messages that can be exchanged along the arrows are always on the same level, the same security level.
Okay, but the codependency, is it specific to the random method in the random interface?
You
should specify that this dependency includes this very specific method.
Yes. So the interface here means that
the interface is part of the random, but I mean the dependency call doesn't mean I may be calling other method in the interface that's not shown here, for example. So and this other method is not doesn't mean high security.
So in general, in this approach, you should give a complete specification. So in the interface, you should actually give all methods that can be called by the other object, because otherwise you miss out security-relevant information. And
what if some of the methods need high security and others do not?
Yeah, that you can specify using this tag. So if you have another method in the interface, random. So you could. So then your interface would look like this. So you have interface random number and. So you would then say critical, meaning that there are critical methods in this interface, and then you have the tag I, and you would maybe just say random, so I equals random, and so we have the method random here. But you may also have a different method here. And this may not have the higher requirement.
I do not need to do that again on the random generator itself. It's sufficient on the interface.
Yes. So yeah, and this is what I just explained on the hand of the example. This is actually on this slide defined more formally, but I think I just explained it on the example. So, but the point is that you can give this constraint on this stereotype secure dependency in a mathematically precise way. So, which is formulated in the bottom half of the slide. Although here it's formulated informally, but you can actually translate it into logical formulas, and then it's actually mathematically precise. And this enables you to actually automatically check this condition, because if it was just formulated informally, then your tool could not check it. But you can actually make it very precise. Yeah, and then another example for such a stereotype in this extension is that of two, actually, no downflow and no upflow. And there I also have an example. So there you have a state chart diagram in your package with two states, and the idea is here that you have an extremely simple model of a bank account, where here our focus is on the fact that the balance on the account should be kept secret, here in fact we have the stronger requirement that not even partial information on the balance should be leaked out. And this is actually not fulfilled by the application because there's this this non-high method Rx, the third method there of type Boolean, which is not required to be of a high level. In the top of the diagram you have high equals WB and RB, but not RX. So that's not a secure method. And this method RX gives you back a flag depending on whether the account balance is over 10,000 or below 10,000. So you could say this in a way, this is what anyone could see. If a person gets an extra service, this means that the bank account balance is over 10,000 or something. And this partial information is actually leaked out by this specification of this object. And if you have the requirement that not even this partial information should be leaked out, which is specified by this no downflow stereotype, then this would actually be violated by this specification. And so this is really a rather strong security requirement, which in many cases you probably would not need. Specifically in this example, it's probably clear if you walk into a bank and there's someone who is treated very friendly by the bank manager, then you know that his bank account is quite has a high balance. So this is something which is level of security which is not provided in practice. Anyway, but this is just for the purpose of the example. And again, on the previous slide, I gave the more precise constraints that is connected with this condition, no downflow, and there's a similar requirement, no upflow, but there should be no upflow in the bottom, which I cannot, well, it's actually similar, completely symmetric. And I should probably hurry up a bit. Data security, that's this you can now use to specify that certain data should be kept secret or should satisfy integrity, which I already explained earlier what this means. And this you can now actually check on the level of the model that there this is fulfilled. And it is actually quite useful to do that. So one of the examples I gave at the beginning of this part of the tutorial was the Needham-Schroeder protocol, which is a famous protocol designed by two experts in the late 70s. And this kind of basic security requirement was not provided already on the model level. So there you could actually see already on this abstract level that something was going wrong. And this kind of mistake you can find using this approach, for example.
You mean that when they proposed the algorithm, they didn't prove its correctness?
Yes, so at that point they did not. And there was this paper in 78 by Needham and Schroeder, where they proposed several security protocols for authentication, and they did not prove the security of the protocols, and in fact there were several mistakes in the protocols. Which
I remember they used the logic of authentication.
This was later, so this what I just mentioned was the 78 paper. Then later they did work, so by Burrows, Abadi and Needham, which Needham, the same Needham, and there they considered the security of the protocol using this Bahn logic as you mentioned, and they proved it secure to some extent. So another problem was that later someone else found another attack, namely Gavin Lowe, also using an abstract approach like this. But this only meant that in using the Bahn logic, they proved the security under certain assumptions. And then Gavin Lowe found another attack which violated these assumptions. And this is of course something you always have to do if you want to say that the system is secure in some sense. You always have to make assumptions and you have to make them very clear. So that's important. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so this is another example for such a protocol which has a flaw which you can find at this level, namely a variant of the Internet Security Protocol TLS, which was proposed at the conference in 1999. And there you can see, if you specify it in this abstract way, that the secrecy requirement is not fulfilled by the protocol. But I cannot explain this in detail here. And yeah, there's another condition which I simply mention here because it's of a different kind, and this is the condition of fair exchange, which plays a role in e-commerce protocols. And this you can also this is also provided by this UMLSEC approach, and this lets you also check that this condition is fulfilled on the design level. And yeah, here's an example which I also don't have the time to explain in detail. Okay, and this is another example which I can explain on a later slide. This relates to the Java security architecture, where you have the guarded objects. It's one of the specific features of this architecture, and those you can also make sure of this kind of stereotype guarded access, to make sure that this is used in a correct way. And an example of that. Okay, and here I now argue why these requirements are actually fulfilled, the ones that I mentioned earlier. So I think I probably don't have to go through that in detail, but if you want the slides, as I said, they will be distributed, so you can read it there. Okay, and now I have to contort something probably. I will see how far I get. So, firstly, as mentioned already, the idea is that you can evaluate the security of your system design also using tool support. But you need a formal semantics for this notation. So until this point, we were just drawing diagrams and saying, okay, we know what this means, but to use tools to check the security, you actually have to be more precise about what it means. And for that, you need this formal semantics, which is given elsewhere. I just mentioned this here, that this is actually part of the work of providing this. And yeah, this is mentioning how this is being done, but I'm not going to explain it exactly. And yeah, this we actually have seen already, the situation of distributed systems and why this is a problem here. And then the way this is being treated in this UMLSEC approach is that you not only model the system using the diagrams, but the UMLSEC approach then provides also a model of the adversary, which is generated from the physical information given in the system. For example, the fact that a link is an internet link and can be accessed by the considered adversary. And this means that all possible kinds of adversary behavior with respect to this link are also included in the general model, which can then be checked automatically. And yeah, well, this general approach is based on earlier work, including the one that you mentioned, the BAN logic. And actually, the first was even earlier in 82 by Dolev and Yao. They had a paper with this idea of considering the security of a computer system on this high abstract level by modeling an attacker who may do the things that we could do in practice realistically. Of course, if there are things in practice that are not mentioned here, this means that you may miss some attacks which are possible in practice. But still, the approach is useful because you may still find enough attacks. And there are examples like the one on this Medium-Fuller protocol. You only have to be aware that this approach is not complete. It's pretty good, and it's, of course, in security, you want any help that you can get. But if you have done this, you're still not done in general. But it's still worth it. And so the technical level, how this works is that the different cryptographical notions are treated as symbols. So you assume that cryptography is working correctly and perfectly at this level, and everything works as it should. So cryptography is taken as a black box, and you then make sure that that cryptography is used correctly within the system context, for example, in security protocols. So this is also the standard approach by Dolev and Yao. And well, this is the more mathematical way of then specifying these cryptographic operations. Well, I'm not explaining this in detail here now, but it is relatively compact. So this is something you could actually implement in a tool which then checks that your protocol uses the cryptographic operations correctly because you abstract from the actual algorithm. So you just say algorithm sign takes a message and signs the message, and we don't worry about how this is being done. We only assume that this is being done in a secure way, and this allows you to actually automatically check the specification making use of the algorithm, because otherwise you cannot check the algorithm automatically. That would be too complicated. And yeah, well, this is only also more technical remarks about how this adversary model is then modeled, which I also don't have the time to explain in detail. Only the point is that you have to keep track of the knowledge that the adversary can gain in interaction with the system. So if an encrypted message is sent out through the internet and the adversary happens to have the encryption key, then you can of course decrypt the message and gain the knowledge contained in the encrypted message. And this you have to model this is being modeled by the UMLSEC approach automatically. And, this is an example how this notion of secrecy is then handled on the formal mathematical level, but I can also not explain this in detail how this works here, but just to show that this is being taken care of at the mathematical level. And while you can also think about how to do this alternatively, this adversary model, and then show that it's actually the same way, but I cannot actually explain this here. Okay, so this was how, in principle, the security analysis is being performed. Only I could just sketch it here. And then a bit about security patterns. Yeah, okay, I can... well, since you asked the question, I will try to tell a bit about it, although I don't have much time. So this is going back to this classic paper by Salz and Schröder, where they gave design principles for security systems. And here I'm showing how to enforce these principles using this approach. So, which works, well, in different ways. So it's not always so straightforward. For example, one of the things they say is economy of mechanisms, that you should keep the system small and simple to increase the certainty that it is actually secure. And this is provided indirectly by this approach, because if you have a method to reassure that your system is secure, then you're not tempted to make it look more complicated, which is what is usually in the practice often the case. So this is an indirect payoff of the method. And something which you could check more directly is this safety false, saying that the access decisions, how they should work, is that in general it should be assumed that no one has access to anything, and if you want to allow someone, you have to say specifically that he is allowed to do something. Rather than the other way around, where you would say by default everyone is allowed to do everything, and if he should be forbidden, then I should specifically say it, which is less secure because you may forget to prevent someone to do something. And this you can actually check on the model, on the level of the model, that the principle is actually being performed here. So this is an example where you can do this more directly.
One question. In this drawing, you are mixing different diagrams together.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is again a package where, you cannot really see it because it's too small, but you have on the bottom again a deployment diagram. Then you have different state charts giving the component behaviors. Then in the top, the class structure and the activity diagram, which coordinates the component behavior.
So what's the point of putting them in one box?
Yeah, that's the UML notation. I mean, yeah, you could also keep them separate, but this is the way that UML specifies that this all of these diagrams relate to one system component. So then they give the different views of the system component named load, and the different views are the class structure, the physical layer, the object behavior, and the coordination of the object behavior. So the point is that it concerns, all of this concerns one system component, namely the one called load. That's why it's put into a package.
But there is no sequence diagram here.
Yeah, in fact, you don't have to use sequence diagrams. Here you can alternatively use state charts to say what each object does by itself, and from that you could derive a sequence diagram saying how the messages flow. Yes. Okay. Yeah, and another principle which you could check on the in a technical way on the level of the specification is complete deviation, saying that every access to every object should actually be checked for authority. And another design which they give, so I listed here also the another principle that the design should not be secret. This is again only more indirectly being addressed by the approach, because of course UML does not tell you to publish your specification. But if you have a way of designing a system securely, then you don't have to rely on keeping the design secret. So this is really a bit matter of taste if you want to follow this rule or not. And another separation of privilege I mentioned earlier, this was this 4i principle, and this you can also enforce using this approach. This I also mentioned already, the least privilege. I mentioned this in the first half of the tutorial, and again, this you can check at the specification level using the UML specification. And I think I will skip the last couple of principles. So there are further principles, some of which you can check quite conveniently using this approach. This one probably again is more indirectly related, because UML doesn't say a lot about psychology, but okay. Okay, this means that the system components should not share more more mechanism as necessary. So in this sense of object orientation, this is enforced because each object encapsulates the data itself. So there's no sharing of data between different objects, except through the methods which exactly.
Attackers should be represented as actors?
So, you mean the UML actors? So in this approach, the attackers do not appear on the specification level. They only appear at the security analysis level, which I sort of sketched on the previous slide. Okay. To the principles in general, it applies that they are just warnings and absolute rules, and some of them you can enforce with this UML back approach. Okay, and now security patterns. So there, maybe related to the earlier question, if you have a specific problem, for example, in this example given earlier, which does not provide a certain security property, then you can use a pattern, which is a transformation from a UML diagram to another one to introduce a more secure version. And here it would be to add this system component, which in a way wraps the earlier component and makes sure that after a security critical interaction, there is no secure information leaked out to an untrusted user. So I can also not explain how this component works, but this is just the general idea how this pattern approach works, that you take a specification which has a flaw in it, and you add or you replace it by another specification which is better in some way. So this relates to the earlier question. And similar example is the pattern of the secure channel pattern. So if you want to keep the data secret, although it should be sent over the internet, then you encrypt it using a protocol, for example, that's given there. So you can, in principle, simply replace this specification, this package, by this package. In this way, it gets more secure. So this is the idea of what you asked earlier. Okay? This means good rules how to design secure systems. So security engineering just meaning designing security critical systems, and prudent just being wise or established rules. Okay, I think I probably should skip the case studies because they, I don't know how, until what time should I think them?
15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because there was someone who was interested in Java security, so I think I sort of leave through the case studies just mentioned. So this one we saw earlier, this DNS protocol, as I said, with this approach one could see that there's a mistake in the protocol, and this gives the specification in more detail. And here I say what exactly it means for the protocol to have flaw, but it's a very strong flaw, so there's not much debate about whether this is a flaw.
Just a quick clarification. You said that now, at this moment, you can find mistakes or errors manually.
Mm-hmm.
How? You put specifications and models and you could graph what.
This is a good question, which I'm not explaining too much detail in this tutorial, but it's a rather high level on the system, on the approach. So what you would do is to firstly write your specification, one of these different diagrams, or collected here, and then you, as I mentioned earlier in the tutorial, I give a formal semantics for the diagrams. So from these diagrams, you get a sort of pseudo code, which tells you the exact dynamical behavior. So this looks a bit more like a specification written in the Bahn logic, which you mentioned already. And on that level, you can, for example, try to prove mathematically that the protocol is secure, like you would do using the Bahn logic. And then at some point, you will notice. For example, you could notice that you're not able to prove that it's secure, and then you would be suspicious that there may be an attack, and that's why you're not able to prove that it's secure. And then after some thinking, hopefully you'll find the attack. Of course, this approach, it's not perfect because it depends on your own thinking, which is not good. it's at least it may be hard work, so...
I like it very much actually. It pops up many things when you see, when you trace the arrows.
Yes.
You can point out, or if you already have a list of the possible attacks, you can tell exactly whether the attack can occur or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, in fact. So this is the next step, the next part of the answer. I mean, the first part is, at this point, you can derive a mathematically precise specification from these diagrams. I mean, I've done this in the thesis. And then you can do manual proving or disproving, which requires work. But what is also possible already is to use an automatic tool. But there you have a slightly different notation, a simpler notation. And it's a tool which was developed in Munich, and it looks actually quite similar to UML, but it's simpler, as I said, because UML is quite expressive, and therefore it's not so easy to provide automatic tool support. So you always have to make compromises. If you want to have automatic tool support, which is efficient and everything, then you probably want to use a simple version of this, which is still intuitive and graphical and everything, but you can then actually push a button, and then there's a model checker in there, and the model checker hopefully will find the attack. So that's automatic, there you don't have to do the thinking, but the machine actually finds the attack. So yeah, but yeah, this I don't really explain here. Okay, yeah, and this is intuitive view of the attack. Was typical man-in-the-middle attack, but I can explain it really. And then you can also specify a modified version of the protocol, and then prove that this is secure. And here you only have to include one piece of information, namely the public key of the client into this one message to make it secure. And that you can then prove. Again, on the level of this formal semantics. And another example which we have considered with this approach, but I can also not explain in detail here, is the smart card-based electronic purse, and which is actually now being developed by Visa International and other companies. I think they want to start implementing the thing this summer. I think that's the current status. And there we look at the specifications which are available publicly and model them using this approach, and also pointed out some subtleties of the specifications. And so there are different parts, and one of the central parts is the load protocol. But yeah, I cannot really explain in detail how this works. But well, again, maybe importantly, it also uses cryptography, of course, which makes it hard to see whether it's secure, and therefore you want to use an approach like this, which is mathematically precise. Yeah, so this is in principle the load protocol is given here, or you cannot read it here because it's too small. But so if I send you the slides, then or
okay.
Yeah, well, there's also a paper which I can send.
No,
this is just some drawing tool which I just used because I wanted to export it into the thesis. Yeah. But in principle, of course, you could also use rational rows, and it would be more convenient in a company setting where you use it anyway. Okay, there are the different views, which I cannot explain in detail here. And then, well, you have to come up with a threat model in order to identify the type of adversary that you're concerned with. This is something you have to do before you actually start to analyze the specification. So there may be different motivations for the different participants to cheat in the protocol. And specifically what I considered in this work was the log keeping, so the auditing of the protocol, that this is being done securely because the specific protocol really relies on the security of the auditing. And then while you formulate the security conditions that have to be fulfilled by the specification, which is here being done informally, but on the level of this formal semantics, you can also do it again in a mathematically precise way. And yeah, this is more closer to the mathematical precise thing, but I cannot really explain this in detail. And then there you can actually also show again at this point, well, I noticed this when I tried to prove that the earlier condition is provided. I noticed that this is not actually the case because the protocol here does not provide what was supposed to be provided in the specification. So here I'm not saying that the protocol is actually completely insecure, but something which was claimed in the specification document is not provided. Namely, I cannot really explain it, but the point is that there's a load acquirer and the card issuer, and there was this signature, mentioned there on the slide, which the specification claimed that that this was a proof for the fact that the load acquirer gets money from the card holder. But it's not really a proof for the simple reason that it's a symmetric key. In the specification, it's a symmetric key shared between the load acquirer and the card issuer, so either of them could have produced the signature. But this they were not aware of, I guess, when they wrote this this claim. Of course, this may not be a problem in practice, because you may say that load acquirer and card issuer have to trust each other anyway, depending on the circumstances. But at least then you should not claim in the specification that this is fulfilled. Yeah, okay, these some case studies and now a bit how to use this in the context of Java security. So there, the situation is that firstly, in the early version of Java, you have the sandbox model. Okay, so the whole concern here is that with Java, you can download applets from the internet, which are, well, you know, little programs which you execute on your computer. And the question then is, what can these applets do? The problem is, again, maybe I don't trust these little programs because I don't know who wrote the web page and I don't know what happened on the way. So maybe the applet was okay, but then it was replaced by some other applet, which is not okay. So they should not be able to do everything. And the original solution was that the applets basically could not do anything except if they were signed by a certain source. But this was not very flexible. This everything or nothing approach. So in the newer versions of Java, you have a more fine-grained security architecture regarding these applets. So now you can actually say what an object coming from a specific location and signed with a specific key should be able to do in the system. So this gives you much more freedom, but it's also more complicated because of this freedom, and you can make more mistakes. And this is why I adapted the UMLSec approach to be able to use it with this security mechanisms.
Where is the sandbox?
So the sandbox means that if you load the applet, then it the applet. Well, so previously the applet is executed in the sandbox. So sandbox meaning it's a place where little children can play and they make nothing wrong. So that's why it's called sandbox. So originally the sandbox means that the untrusted applet is sitting in one part of the system where it cannot do anything wrong. So it can only play with sand, make little sand cakes, but it cannot delete any files or read any files or do really anything serious. But this was the old situation. And the new situation is, the sandbox is still around for backward compatibility, but you can then also allow the applets to do more things, depending on where they come from and what are they signed with. And that's what's more complicated. So the way you specify this using permissions, and firstly you have to specify protection domains. So this is similar to the idea of roles, which I mentioned earlier, where you group together individuals into roles, and you group together applets into protection domains, so to be able to treat them in an easier way. So this means that depending on where the applet comes from, namely the location, the URL of the web server, and depending on which keys the applet is signed with, it is in a certain protection domain, which is defined by these properties. And then the permission entry also says what applets from this protection domain should be able to do. For example, read a certain file on a certain directory on the local machine. The permission also says what the applet should be able to do, either read or write or execute, for example.
They have the assumption that the quality file is protected in the system.
Yeah.
I mean, no one can change it.
Yes.
In the system.
Yes. Yeah. That's important.
So it's just text file thrown in the file system.
This is the assumption that this is secure. Then, of course, if you another question is: to what extent the Java system enforces this assumption? And I mean, there have also been a lot of examples in the past where people found holes in the Java security architecture. So at this point, we would probably hope that it is being done securely, but there's no perfect certainty either. But by now, it should be pretty secure because a lot of people have looked at it, and any holes that were there, hopefully, or most of them have been found. But okay, yeah. And so another feature of this Java security architecture is then these signed and sealed objects, which means firstly that a signed object, as I mentioned already, you give a signature to the object which certifies where the object comes from and who wrote it. And then you can also seal an object to make sure that the data which is transmitted in the object over the internet is not read by other people. And then thirdly, there's another part of this new Java security architecture called guarded objects. There you can control the access to one of the objects at runtime by using guard objects which check certain guards that should be fulfilled at execution time. And this is especially flexible but also hard to ensure correctly, and this is also what then UMLSec helps you with. Well, yeah, here I give several reasons why this is complicated, which I cannot explain in detail here. And yeah, here I simply say how to do it with UML in a general way. And yeah, and then you can, if you do this, then you, if you do it correctly, you can actually again prove on the level of formal semantics that this was being done in a correct way. And here I give an example, of, again very simple, where the applets should have certain permissions which should hold at certain times of the execution. So there you can again see that it it's really execution dependent, which makes it very powerful but also difficult to use. And this you can ensure using UMLSec that these requirements are actually enforced correctly. Yeah, but I cannot really explain this example in more detail. So there you have the behavior of the guards, and you can again on the level of formal semantics ensure that this is correct. Yeah, this is what's being given here basically. Yeah, and I think Korba I really cannot explain here which, but the approach is similar to that of the Java security architecture. Outlook means just Outlook and not you mean
specific details are
not in the sense of the
Outlook object.
Yes, not in the sense of the Outlook, but I give it on. Okay. But I think we have to do this anyway now. So yeah, as I mentioned, or the regarding to the earlier question, there is tool support by this autofocus tool, which is similar, where the notation is similar to UML, but not quite the same. But you can actually do a lot of things, like hit sequence generation, where you can check then the implementation, and you have a model checker, and you can generate code and everything. And what's the current work is to actually connect a UML drawing tool to this analysis machine. And yeah, there's my homepage, which is also given somewhere else, maybe. Otherwise, you can write it down. And I guess the slides are also going to be distributed. So I guess this is the end of the tutorial. Are there any questions?
Any questions? I know this has been a long tutorial and it is full of precious information. And perhaps this is an introduction that the people can follow up in the future. So if there are no more questions, we would like to thank Dr. Jan Jürgen for his very informative and ambitious approach for designing a secure software, and we'd like to give him our applause. And as I promised, I will use the remaining left to send you the 104 pages of documentation on this part of the presentation. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so
thank you.
Very good work.
Okay, thank you.
need to get to be more known to other people.
I'm working on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, I'm very interested in this field very much. I work in a company called Egyptian Banks Company, which is in the field of finance, and we were modeling transaction processing systems, and